20th, 1977. My name is James Murphy, and I'm talking with Captain John Grant, formerly of the RCN. Captain Grant, last time we were talking, we were talking about convoy duty. After you completed your tour in Plymouth, you were posted to the Mediterranean. What ship did you serve on in the Mediterranean?
I continued to serve in the HMS Beaver. Now, it is usual in the Royal Navy, when talking about ships, to omit HMS, because they were all HMS, you see. And so we speak of a ship as Beaver or Suffolk or Berwick, and you probably find that's the way I go on. Well, the Beaver was ordered out to the Mediterranean station. We left Plymouth on April 7th, 1918. We had the Forrester, another destroyer, the same class as the Beaver, in company, and we escorted two cruisers and a large troop ship. On the 8th, at sea, we parted company with the ships, with the convoy, and we went on. The weather was rather poor. The Bay of Biscay lived up to its reputation, though it wasn't too bad. However, on April the 9th, we were abreast of Lisbon at 4 p.m. and sighted Cape Roca. On the following day, we arrived at Gibraltar in the morning, and I went ashore with some of the my shipmates, and dined, had a very good dinner at the Hotel Bristol, and went to a Spanish theatre. We left Gib next morning very early, escorting, forming part of the escort of 10 ships. We were bound for Bizerta in Tunisia. It was a beautiful morning, and the weather, of course, much warmer. That didn't last very long, came on to rain and blow, and my idea of the Mediterranean rather changed at that time. On the 13th, we received orders, together with the Forrester, to rendezvous with the Narcissus, another destroyer, was about halfway back to Gibraltar. We were all rather bored about this, as we wanted to get on with our job. However, we rendezvoused with the Narcissus, and who was standing by a ship which had been torpedoed at about 6 a.m. that morning. We proceeded to screen the torpedo ship, that is, to give her protection, while the Narcissus took her in tow, which we thought was a very good work on her part, as it was a heavy sea running, and it was not an easy thing to do to get a wire on board. We, after she had been taken in tow, and the arrangements were all made, we started off for Cartagena Bay, but the torpedoed ship sank almost immediately, and we put it down to the fact that she probably, a bulkhead, one of her main bulkheads had been damaged, and it gave way, no doubt, and caused the sinking of the ship. Fortunately, there was no loss of life. We had anticipated there might be trouble of that kind. We tried to pick up a bit of the wreckage, but there was too heavy a sea running, and we were unable to pick up anything. We arrived at Bizerta at noon, and the Narcissus returned to Gibraltar. We took a pilot on board and proceeded up what was really a canal. I imagine it was originally a river of some sort, but it had been improved for the passage of ships up to Ferryville. And at Ferryville, we went alongside the oiling jetty and had considerable trouble getting the people who manned the equipment to do their job properly. But eventually we completed with our fuel, and received our orders shortly after completing the fuel from a motor launch known as an ML, whose commanding officer was a Canadian. The next day we steamed down to Bizeta, leaving Ferryville at 5:30 in the morning, and we caused great excitement and no little displeasure in the canal due to the wash of the Forester. The Forester was the senior officer, so he was leading us, and he didn't consider the fact that his wash was so big and was washing over both sides of the canal. And in one case it washed a donkey with a man on board down the far bank on our starboard hand. He just disappeared. This amused the ship's company, but of course did not amuse the man riding the donkey, and we heard more about that incident later. We later that day we left Bizeta and escorted a troop ship to Malta. A quite uneventful passage. We arrived at Malta in the late afternoon, securing in what was known as Dockyard Creek.
So you were still doing basically convoy duty, escort duty in the Mediterranean?
Yes, our duties in the Mediterranean varied greatly, particularly when we reached our base, which was, I think I've given you the name, but I was there a long time. I'll soon remember it. I just have a note of it here. It's one of the main naval bases of the Italian fleet in the Mediterranean.
Brindisi?
And was, yes, Brindisi, the Italians pronounce it. And it was in the Straits of Otranto, which is the narrow, about the narrowest part of the Adriatic Sea, and was a rather dull spot. The land was very flat in the vicinity of Brindisi, but there was wonderful swimming, which I enjoyed very much indeed, so I quite enjoyed my time at Brindisi.
That while you were at Brindisi, you participated in the bombardment of Durazzo.
We at Brindisi. See, I really, I think I ended up by saying we were secured to a trot in Dockyard Creek at Malta,
uh-huh.
And we proceeded to Bizeta in the early morning. No. Sorry, I've become confused. That's actually what did happen, but I really got ahead of myself, you see. We're still at Malta. At Malta, I met a great number of old shipmates from cruiser days, and found there was all sorts of entertainment. There was a theatre, and had the occasional opera company came from Italy, and there was a very good club, where one could dine comfortably and reasonably, and it was a wonderful place for games. Lots of the officers played polo. I was not a polo player myself, but swimming, rugby, ground hockey were the chief games. And one very active game was so-called polo, played in the junior officers' club with croquet sticks and billiard balls mounted on boardroom chairs, where we used to attack each other fiercely and have the most frightful battles. That was just one of the way we entertained ourselves. Also, we used to go away boat pulling, really with the idea of keeping fit. The entire wardroom would turn out, and on one occasion, my captain, we were sailing outside the harbour and returning to enter between the two gate vessels, when he miscalculated the wind and put us not ashore, but hard up against the nets on leading from one gate vessel to the shore, where we had considerable difficulty getting away because of the wind blowing us onto the nets. Also, on that particular day, I distinguished myself by falling overboard out of the whaler. Then we followed a rather, not dull routine, but rather constant routine. I'd meet with some of my old shipmates, and we'd dine at the club, and perhaps go to a theatre. And also there were a number of wrens in Malta, which made a very pleasant change, as we were able to take them out to dine, and perhaps to a theatre. On May the 10th, we left Malta in the forenoon and proceeded to Syracuse. Syracuse being south of the Straits of Messina and an Italian port, and very, very beautiful. We secured alongside a long stone jetty, and we took with us, well, we were taking people on passage, service people who had to proceed there on service matters. But I was very, very taken with Syracuse. I only went there on one other occasion. We weighed, weighed means, of course, we weighed anchor. Right. We weighed at in the evening, and after a very, very smooth and enjoyable passage, we arrived at Messina at 9:30 p.m. It was lovely in the Straits, and with the sun setting behind Mount Etna, was an extraordinarily beautiful sight. In Messina Harbour, we secured alongside an oiler and completed with fuel.
What was fueling with the oil? How long would it take to fuel a ship? It was simpler than coaling, but was it still fairly messy?
Oh, very much simpler. Fueling simply amounted to going alongside. We nearly always went alongside a tanker, and pipes, flexible pipes, flexible metal pipes, were heaved on board with the aid of blocks and tackle and probably a temporary yardarm put up to keep the cable at a high level, and they were simply connected up by a fueling party, who were always the same people, very good at their job. They were secured to the end of the pipe from the oiler, was secured to the pipe leading to our oil fuel tanks, and secured very carefully to prevent any leakage of oil, which not only would have polluted the water, but would have made the decks very dangerous to walk on. And I think to complete, we always kept our tanks full. Whenever we had the chance, we would complete with the oil fuel in order to take the precaution of not running short. The length of time, I would think, if we were nearly out of fuel, was probably about an hour and a half. This included time for changing the supply pipes to different fuel tanks in the ship.
How far, what was the cruising range of the Beaver?
Well, Beaver was very fast for that class of destroyer. She did 32 knots. Now that is, behind you on the wall there is a picture of her doing speed trials in the Clyde. And you see she's 810 tons, and I think I said before she had 2 4-inch guns and twin above water torpedo tubes, 21-inch tubes, and 12-pounders and smaller armament. But she had wonderful sea-keeping qualities and no difficulty whatsoever in steaming from, say, as far as Endurance was concerned, from Malta to Portsmouth. She had good, very good sea-keeping qualities. At one time, I didn't mention it, or I may have mentioned it, when I was based at Plymouth, we were detached to join up with American destroyers operating out of Brest, and they had very small destroyers with less sea-keeping capacity than the British destroyer of the same tonnage, but I had the greatest admiration for them because they suffered very badly in heavy seas. They were very, very uncomfortable. But they were very good to us in Brest. They had an officer's club there and they used to entertain us very nicely. Well, now, we had...
Fueling at Syracuse.
At Messina.
Messina.
We proceeded to Messina, yes. And that's where, from there, in entering Messina, you can see Mount Etna, which I believe at the present time is erupting now. I heard on the wireless or on the, read in the paper. At Messina, I landed with a number of my best mates, and we climbed a small mountain and explored the town of Messina and the surrounding country for the time that was available for us to do so.
How did the people react to sailors in the Royal Navy, the Italians, were they friendly, indifferent, or?
I would say that on the whole, they were very good to us all. They were certainly very good to the young officers, and I never remember hearing any complaint whatsoever from any of our own seamen about their reception and treatment by the Italian sailors. I never remember hearing a word of disparagement. Now, during that night, I see it was in the afternoon, a troop ship in the Straits of Messina was torpedoed She had 4,000 men on board, and unfortunately she went down very quickly, and only 2,000 were saved. That was the sort of thing, of course, that was happening frequently, and of course was fearful loss of life and loss of stores and armament and so on due to our ships being torpedoed. We left Messina at midnight and proceeded to Brindisi in the Straits of Otranto, an Italian naval port, an oil fuel port, and lots of room for, well, there were Italian battleships there, as well as a cruiser squadron, if not two cruiser squadrons, and a British cruiser squadron, which was there temporarily to assist the Italians. Going along the coast, we went round under the foot of Italy. The scenery was magnificent because on the Italian coast it's very typical to have villages situated bang on top of small mountains, high hills, and very often they were walled for defensive purposes from former days when they were attacked by pirates or other nationals, and all along the Italian coast at intervals you see round towers. They were known as the Saracen towers, because they had been built originally to defend the local inhabitants from the Saracens. We arrived at Brindisi early in the afternoon of the 13th of May, and after completing with oil fuel, were directed to our permanent moorings, which was known as the Hospital Trot, undoubtedly because the hospital was not far away. We now, our duties at Brindisi were entirely anti-submarine. Almost entirely anti-submarine duties. We would work with one division, that's four destroyers, or two divisions of destroyers, patrolling as wide an area as we could without wasting oil fuel. And in those days, destroyers were fitted not with ASDIC, as they are now, but with hydrophones,
right,
which was very, I don't think I've described them before on the...
Yes, we talked about that last time.
We talked about it on the mic. Oh, well, then I won't repeat that.
Wow.
No, because that's, we haven't time for that. Our routine was very much the same. Week after week, we'd be on patrol for 2 days and then one day in harbour. And tennis was the game made available to us by the local officers, local clubs. I used to spend lots of time swimming and played a bit of tennis.
So now, the day, 2 days on patrol, then one day off was yours?
One day in harbour, of course, there's always something to do to the ship.
Oh, yes.
You know, because with the constant steaming and very little attention from very little dockyard assistance, the ship's company had to pretty well maintain the ship themselves. And of course, all sorts of things were happening to... Everything wears out in time, even our armament, or navigation and equipment, or sub-defect develops. And one of the... by this time, I was the executive officer, the first attendant of the Beaver, and one of my duties was to keep a list of all defects as they developed, and eventually we returned to Genoa, or we proceeded to Genoa, and were taken and went into dockyard hands and had these defects made good. Now, on the 18th of October, together with five other destroyers, we started off for the Dardanelles. It was blowing very hard with a head sea, and two of the destroyers were unable to maintain the speed of the depot ship, the Blenheim, and they had to drop astern. However, we rounded Cape Matapan, at the southern end of Italy, of Greece. That's, Cape Matapan, of course, is in Greece, and there was a battle fought off later on, No, in the Second War, was it not the Battle of Matapan, the Second War? Yes. And so it today became rather famous in the Royal Navy. We sighted Cyprus and proceeded to the harbour of Mudros in the island of Lemnos, which lies westward off the entrance to the Dardanelles. The distance I'm not quite sure of, but a couple of hours steaming. Mudros was a wonderful harbour and was used throughout the whole war and before by the Royal Navy for various purposes. Now we did the usual thing there, we completed the oil fuel, and we now became engaged on what really amounted to secret duties with the Turks. And for instance, several days after we arrived at Mudros, we embarked a Turkish lieutenant commander whose name was Tewfik Bey, T-E-W-F-I-K, capital B-E-Y. Now, you'll notice that I mentioned very few names, and I think that's better policy. I don't mention the names of my shipmates and my commanding officers, and though I know them all, and have a record of them, of course, but I think personal names perhaps don't quite fit into a record of this kind, unless they happen to be very, very distinguished people. Well, we took Tewfik Bey to the Greek island of Chios, from where he crossed to the mainland of Turkey in Asia by motorboat. Tewfik came to, in the first instance, to Mudros in the Forester with General Townsend, who you remember, I imagine, from your history studies. He was a very famous general who did extremely well for the British in against the Turks. We returned to Mudros on the 23rd of October. Now, on the 25th, we proceeded with other destroyers to Stavros. And Stavros is a small port, hardly a port. We landed on a beach, a very beautiful beach, and Mount Athos is on this long neck of land, a point of land, which runs in a southerly direction, and Mount Athos is beautifully situated right on a high point, on a mountaintop really, and Stavros is not very far from Salonika. There we embarked together with ten other destroyers. We embarked ourselves, 13 officers and 329 men. Now, the Beaver was not very big, and so there was hardly an inch of space to stow these people, and also the weather turned nasty, and quite heavy seas started running, and these poor chaps was stowed all over the ship. The wardroom, which is rather small, was chock-a-block, and they had to seek protection behind something on the upper deck, in the engine room, and in the tiller flat, any possible space they could find. And most of them, unfortunately, were seasick. 10 other destroyers, yes, were 10 others in addition to us, embarked approximately the same number of men. So, that would have been 10 times, see, that'd be 3,290 and some 130 officers. Now, we steamed across the Aegean Sea and when we arrived off the coast, which was then in Turkish hands, this is north of the entrance to the Dardanelles, we found a barge-like ship, which were called Kalaiters. Now they were really the beginning of tanks, landing craft. They're known as landing craft tanks, landing craft personnel, landing craft, all sorts of things. But ours were personnel, and they were not meant to carry heavy equipment or armament, but for personnel with small arms, in other words, light infantry. Well, it blew so hard, and the sea started to get up, we couldn't land these poor chaps. So there were tugs towing the Kalaiters, and they took them away and got to leeward of an island, Imbros, I think, which lay not far away. And we took the troops all back to Stavros, landed them again there, much to their disgust and much to our disgust.
What was the purpose? Were they to make an assault? Or?
Well, I have no idea. But there was a railway running from, we landed at Dediagetsch. Dediagetsch is the name, that's marked on the maps. And that was the name of a small, we had to land, when we eventually landed, which was the next day, these Kalaiters, the forward part of the bow, just like a tank, it could be lowered, and they could, the men could jump ashore, probably up to their waist in water, depended on the sheltering of the beach, of course. But they proceeded inland, and we never heard of them again. I had the names of all the officers who were embarked in Beaver, and the commanding officer was a Major Rickwood. Now, I don't know the name of the regiment, which was very silly of me, but of course it was a terribly busy time, because we had all these young officers and 300 and something men to look after, who were all feeling miserable and just wanting the voyage to end. Well, it was too hard, too much sea to man the K-lighters, and so we had to return to Stavros. Oh, I see here, I have a note that the lighters took shelter behind the island of Samothrake, which was not far from Deryagatch. We disembarked the troops again at Stavros, and then next forenoon we embarked them again, and the flotilla left harbour. We must have left very early in the morning, because I see that we disembarked them in the K-lighters at Deryagatch at 7:15 a.m. on the 28th. Now, I see I have played football the following day, so we must have returned to Mudros. One of our duties, we were based at Mudros for some time, and one of our duties there was to patrol. You see, we were still at war with Turkey, and so we were to patrol between Imbros and Samothrake, and we used to go ashore occasionally and to try and get a bit of shooting. But as far as I remember, none of us were good shots, and I think perhaps we got one total bag, I think, was one partridge. Now, we patrolled off Sulva. Now, Sulva Beach came into the Dardanelles campaign a lot, the name Sulva. Well, we used to patrol off that. Our idea was to try and see what the Turks were doing, and make sure that they were not making provision to attack Mudros. Well, they had no intention of doing anything of the kind, I'm sure. Now, that routine of patrolling off the Dardanelles carried on until the about the 5th of November, when we proceeded to boiler clean. A boiler clean is something that has to be done quite frequently in destroyers. All the tubes have to be in the boilers. Yarrow's water tube boilers. And with thousands of tubes in them, in which the steam was generated, and provided the steam for the turbines, of course. Turbines were our power. Now, on the 10th, we left harbour, that is the harbour of Mudros and the island of Lemnos, the Beaver and the Hind. The Hind is another destroyer of the same class. And we were escorting our depot ship. the Blenheim through the Dardanelles. At least that was the intention. But our sweeps, the high-speed submarine sweeps which I've spoken before, they picked up the bottom. That means they're grounded. Now, there was something wrong with our, with the soundings that we'd been given, with our depth-setting mechanism. So we hauled them on board, which is a tricky business. We didn't get everything aboard. We lost one or two paravanes. And however, we proceeded. The senior officer was in the depot ship, and he was determined to get through the Sea of Marmara. So on we went without our sweeps. Now, 9 a.m. the next day, we anchored at Ismid. Now, Ismid is in the Gulf of Ismid, in the extreme southeastern point of the Sea of Marmara. Absolutely extreme point. And Ismid was rather a small place, but anchored in the Gulf was the Goeben. Now, the Goeben and the Breslau were two German cruisers that had caused great consternation in the Mediterranean. They broke out of the Dardanelles and were a constant menace to our convoys. However, they were eventually driven through the Dardanelles under the protection of the Turkish guns and Turks themselves. And the Blenheim, I think, was sunk in the Mediterranean. And was not, she certainly was not at Ismid, and she wasn't at Constantinople, so I think she must have been sunk, torpedoed probably, by the British before she could escape.
We only have about a couple of minutes left again.
Oh gosh, is it awful?
There's one question that intrigues me. What was the Royal Navy doing carrying a Turfik Bey around when he was
did I mention the date? On the 11th we entered the Dardanelles at noon. The 11th an armistice had been declared with Turkey some days before that. Mm-hmm. Now we were halfway through the Dardanelles when the armistice with Germany was announced. And so this trotting the Turks about, and there was a lot of it going on, was the arranging of the on-the-spot arranging between the British and the Turks and our other allies of this preliminary armistice.
Oh,
and that's why we were halfway through the Dardanelles when we heard of the general armistice, whereupon we proceeded to splice the main brace. That means all have a drink and to celebrate it. We then went, as I told you, we went on to Ismid and the next day we went up to Constantinople and there at Constantinople we were embarking. Well, the royalist officers who had been driven there by the Bolsheviks, because of course the Russian Revolution had started in 1917. You see, I'm talking about, we're discussing now the events in November 1918.
Right.
Well, the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, had started quite a long time before we were there, and Constantinople was full of refugees from Russia, the loyalist refugees, and these were these who eventually were all embarked and taken to Malta, from where they proceeded to back to England. Now, at Ismid, we carried out gunnery practice with what was known as one-inch ARP. You put little guns
in the big ones.
In the big ones, yes, and one-inch aiming they were. And they were, it was very, very effective practice because you went through exactly the same routine as if you were firing the gun itself.
In the just the couple of seconds that we have left, well, when did the bombardment of Durazzo take place?
We returned to returned, of course, to I must learn how to proceed at greater speed with this.
Oh no. Today's July the 25th, 1977, and my name's James Murphy, and I'm talking with Captain John Grant, formerly of the RCN. Well, Captain Grant, when we left off last weekend, I'd asked you about the bombardment of Durazzo. I think that would be a good place for us to start. Now, it occurred in early October